Good morning. It's June 25th, 2019, and I'm calling to order the meeting of the Board of Supervisors. And if you would like to, please join us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Agenda today. Is there a motion?
I would so move.
Moved by Olson.
Second.
Second by Hedden. Any discussion? If not, Olson?
Aye.
Hedden?
Aye.
Aye. Merkin? Aye. Agenda is adopted. Now I'll open public comment period number one, and this comment period is for the public to address any topics that are on today's agenda. And if you would like to address any of the topics, would you please move to the microphone now? Seeing nobody move to the microphone, I will close public comment session number one. The next item is the appointment of supervisors as representatives for the remainder of the calendar year 2019. As you all know, Supervisor Sanders left us a little over a month ago, and that left some boards and commissions that needed to be staffed by the supervisors or have a designated representative by the Board of Supervisors. We looked at all our committee assignments and came up with a new list. Some of those are current, and some are things that we've transferred around. Representative Heddens is taking her full share of board and commission appointments, and we thank her for that. And the packet is in the agenda. Is there a motion to approve?
I would move that we approve as the committees are listed.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Motion is second. Any discussion? If not, Olson?
Aye.
Hedden?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye. We have new assignments. So, next is acknowledgement and receipt of bids for the sale of bonds for $3 million for StoryCom. Treasurer Rasmussen, are you in the room?
Good morning, Ted.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, this spring, the board worked with Lisa Markley and some other members for budgeting. We determined that for StoryCom, we would put the $3 million bond bid out ourselves in the county to save a little money rather than going through a bond representative. We set it up for a 15-year term. That's what we had budgeted out for the levy. We sent the bid out to 11 banks here in Story County. We got the receipt of one bid from First National Bank in Ames at a rate of 3.9% over the 15-year term, which should be attached to the agenda. So I would recommend that we accept the First National Bank bid, and our goal would be to complete the bond paperwork by the end of this week so that then we can have this all wrapped up in fiscal year 19. In speaking with their representative, I think we can make that happen. So we will hope to get that completed as quickly as possible.
Just a clarification, you just said 3.9, the document says 3.95.
Oh, thank you, 3.95. I'm sorry about that.
Just wanted to make sure since it's kind of a big number.
Yes, okay, yes.
Yeah, we get it right for the record. Okay.
I have a question, but go ahead.
Okay. The first one is only one bid. Do we know why this was not a popular bidding instrument?
There's a lot of concerns about rates right now, where they're going, whether they're going up or down. A lot of the banks are uncertain where they want to be. Some other feedback we got at the moment is that it would be more attractive as a 10-year bid. So a lesson learned going forward is in future bond bids, we may want to look at a 10-year levy rather than a 15-year levy. One other item of feedback we got was include a fee for an early buyout of the bond. That's something that our team wasn't real I don't know, did not feel that good about, because that could then tie future boards to a bond when they have funds that they might want to get out of. And our responsibility to the public is always to try to use the most of their tax dollars. So if we see a significant turn in rate, we would want to buy out of this bond and enter into a new bond if we can get a better rate over the course of the bond. So we've never really been in favor of allowing for a fee for early execution of the bond.
I want to comment about the 10-year versus 15-year. The next bonds that we're going to put out for the secondary roads are going to be 20-year. When we put the budget together, that was determined by, you know, this board that, or by the board, that because of the projects themselves, StoryCom, the life expectancy on it is 15 to 20 years before we need to upgrade again, which it's been way more than that this time anyway. And the secondary roads bonds, again, we did a 20-year on those. So I feel the pain of the banks in not wanting to commit for 15 years, that's what's best for the county, and that's how we put the structure of the levy together.
Okay. One other comment we did get was, because this is an essential county purpose bond, these are not tax exempt. So that some of the general obligation bonds with their tax exempt status are a more attractive bond bid for the banks.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Any other questions?
No, I don't have any other.
Okay. Thank you for your work on this, and thank you for the explanation. With no further questions, I'll entertain a motion to approve.
I'll move the sale of the bond at the 3.95% rate.
I second.
Okay. Further discussion? If not, Hedman?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye. Thank you very much. Now we are down to agency reports. Andrew Allen from YSS. Good morning, Andrew.
Morning. Thanks so much for giving us the opportunity to present. I think we used to do this quarterly. I don't mind just doing it annually, but really grateful for the chance to just express our appreciation and talk about the great work that's going on around the county through YSS Services. Let me also just say congratulations, Lisa, and what an honor it is to present to the first all-female Board of Supervisors in the state of Iowa. That's pretty cool. So you're representing us well. Thanks so much for all that you guys do. You each know YSS pretty intimately, but I thought I'd just share a little bit of background to bring you back up to speed. We open up maybe 10,000 case files on kids every year. We present to over 40,000 kids in different venues. We're really focused in seven distinct communities, but we've got two statewide contracts to serve kids in foster care and who have aged out of foster care. But our core, kind of our base, is Story County. We're accredited by CARF. We just recently, last year, received a three-year accreditation. We've got HUD, Housing Urban Development, on site for a week. This week, we probably have 12 different entities come in every year and do reviews or audits of our work, so we're well-versed in that. I think about my focus, and I'm going to just kind of open things and then turn the show over to the real folks that do our programs. I think about my focus as really this double bottom line, right? So there's a financial piece of it around sustainability, and we're sure facing some headwinds there. But then also around impact, you know, at the end of the day, we get out of bed every day to create impact, to change lives, and create hope and opportunity. I think a lot about a strong operational administrative backbone, and then programs in four distinct areas. Programs for all kids, prevention and treatment programs. So prevention, going into the schools, you'll hear from Jerry and her team about the stuff that we're doing there, trying to give kids and families good information to make decisions to set them on a path for success. Treatment is generally the outpatient therapy and counseling services and inpatient substance abuse treatment. Those two programs for everybody, all Story County residents. Transitional services, really just for homeless or near homeless, and we do a lot there. And then child welfare services, and Terry and Emily are going to talk a little bit about that. Generally just for kids in the child welfare system. We operate off a strategic plan that's a little bit bigger than this, but the high level is just one page front and back. When I showed up, George had a really great three-ring binder. The asset actually said, stop sending us that strategic plan because you're killing too many trees. And it was a great strategic plan, very, very detailed, but today we try to keep it at a high level. We set a vision statement for the organization 3.5 years ago. We determined what our core purpose was. We set a 5-year, big, hairy, audacious goal. One was around financial security and one was around impact. We set a target market. We created a 3-year picture. We've got a 1-year plan, and then we break it up into quarterly rocks each quarter. I will say that we're facing financial headwinds. I think it's not unique to YSS, but the nonprofit sector in general doesn't have a great business model. I spent 15 years at Principal Financial Group where, you know, they've got a margin on all of their business. They've got resources to, you know, get things done, and they'll evaluate going into certain sectors, and they'll only go there if they can make it work financially. YSS on a regular basis competes with other nonprofit agencies to take on contracts that we know we're going to lose money. And so we've got to make that up somewhere. Oftentimes we can do that through donations, but not always. So, you know, Jerry Foxhoven left DHS last week or the week before last. There's a lot of uncertainty there about what the plans are. Again, we're heavily dependent upon both the state and federal government and also local, county, and city government for a lot of our funding. So there's just some uncertainty there right now. Medicaid, as you sure well know, and the privatization of Medicaid, bringing in for-profit entities to administer the payments, essentially they can do two things to make money. They can either not pay us, or, you know, complicate the system such that it makes it difficult to draw down on reimbursements, paying us less. So we're really struggling because the majority of our funding for mental health services does come from Medicaid. We're not maybe really disappointed as an agency that United is leaving because they were probably the worst of all three that we have had, but the strain that it puts on families who have to transition is really difficult. So we're facing those headwinds. I think about increased costs. I see some of our insurance folks in the crowd. Our health insurance costs over the previous 3 years up 46% and then 30% year over year. So almost $700,000 in increased costs around health insurance. So just thinking about the cost of doing business, sometimes YSS will sign a 5 or 6 year contract with the state of Iowa where it's going to be the same amount for 5 or 6 years. And as we want to plan for increases in salary, for cost of living, and just performance increases, and then also have other increases around health insurance, it's difficult sometimes to make that work. Facilities, we also have a lot of deferred maintenance on our facilities. YSS has put our programs in old houses. That worked for quite a while, but we're really trying to think about how can we create an environment where the facility is actually helping us to provide a service as opposed to holding us back. And then I would just say ultimately, you know, YSS is really just trying to scan the environment and determine, you know, where the needs are. I think that it's part of the reason that I had stepped up to sit on the Children's System State Board, now the Children's Behavioral Health System State Board, which is codified by code, to help create the Children's Behavioral Health System. And I want to talk a little bit about that because I think that the county and the region will have a role there for sure. I'll address real quickly, we did lose the IDPH block grant. We've talked about that here. We've talked to Deb and folks about that. We had planned to partner with CFR. It fell through towards the end of the application process. We've appealed that decision. We've appealed it to the administrator, and we're still waiting to hear back from him. Ultimately, I think that we are better together. We're better together in a partnership. If we could come up with some way that CFR and YSS could partner, I think that would be great. Having said that, the loss to YSS was about $90,000 Our prevention programs are north of $2 million. So this was a small amount of money for us to lose, and I just want you guys to know, as our current sitting board, is that we are committed to prevention. We're committed to ensuring that we identify lanes. So if there's things that CFR is supposed to be doing, that's great. We'll let them do it. But there's plenty of need to go around across the county from a prevention standpoint, and we're committed to that. And you're going to hear a little bit about that momentarily. Schools are really asking us. We've got long-standing, deep relationships with community partners in Story County, especially the schools. They're asking us for mental health services and awareness. We think about the, you know, mental health first aid that we provide. They're asking for resources around suicide prevention and awareness. They're asking for resources around vaping. I think that that's a significant issue right now among young people. The mental health behavioral health system, House File 690 that the governor signed just 2 months ago, really is the framework. There's not a ton of substance. I sat on that board. You know, we kind of had a task to get it done in about four meetings. We did have some subcommittees. Generally speaking, we all feel pretty good about the framework that's been set. Having said that, there's a lot of work to do to nail down the details and to get funding in place. There are some core services, one of which is crisis stabilization for kids. So the county and the regions went through a process to ensure that there was crisis stabilization for adults. A couple of years ago, you partnered with Mary Greeley. You gave them, or at least leased them, one of the houses. You're paying for that through the region. That's going to be a similar expectation for kids going forward. The region in North Iowa, County Social Services, headed by Bob Lincoln, we've got some locations in Mason City. They're already doing it. We just signed a contract with them to do crisis stabilization for kids in our shelter. They're going to pay us a reimbursed rate per kid per day, and I'm excited to get that and use that as a model or a framework for something that could be done here in Story County. And I mentioned the capital piece of this. You've heard me talk about YSS recovery centers for a couple of years, had this big vision. We pursued 75 acres south of Ames. A lawsuit came. I think you're still actually in that lawsuit. We turned our attention to Mason City, and so we raised about $3 million to do a big renovation in Mason City. We're back now thinking about Central Iowa. And our plans have evolved some from a world-class facility to just best-in-class. YSS is, you know, not necessarily the amenity-type organization, but we really want to provide best-in-class services with best-in-class space. And we've evolved it from just simply addiction treatment to also emergency shelter. So as we think about the needs that exist with this behavioral health system, with the shelter system, we're really going to work on creating a behavioral health campus here in Central Iowa. Likely in Story County, we need about 10 acres to do this. It's going to be difficult to find that inside city limits within Ames. So we've got a couple of different sites. We haven't necessarily found the perfect site yet. We're doing a feasibility study as it relates to the fundraising right now. We've raised just over $1 million towards what we think would be, if we go forward, about a $5.5 million campaign. So I'm excited about the crisis stabilization piece of that as it relates to shelter. I think that we can divert a lot of kids from emergency rooms. As you know, Mary Greeley shut down their adolescent psychiatric unit almost 2 years ago. So if a kid has a need in Story County and they go to Mary Greeley, they're going to sit in the waiting room, in the emergency room, until they can get a transporter to come pick the kid up and take them halfway across the state. And I've talked to a dad who had a kid sit in the ER for more than 24 hours and had a transporter come and pick him up and drive him all the way to Council Bluffs. That is not a great way to serve kids. That creates trauma that actually makes the problem worse. And so if there is a way that we can do that here locally, right, with local funds, right here in Story County, where the family can visit the kids, where our staff can continue to meet the needs of the family and get them connected to resources here, as opposed to having them sit in an emergency room and then go all the way across the state, I'm excited for that. I'm going to turn over my staff now. The impact that we're creating is great. I looked through the report. Jerry assembled this. The team puts it together. I added up. This is just through three quarters. I added up the numbers as it relates to the impact, and numbers of kids served was in excess. It was 9,716 kids through the first three quarters just in Story County. So we really, really want to thank you for your support. One thing that I want to note before I turn it over is when I showed up 3.5 years ago, I would say about half of the funds that we got through the county were through asset, half were direct contracts that we had and established over the years based on a need that existed within the county. From an efficiency standpoint, it made sense for the county and even YSS to move those to the asset process. But there was long conversation with Deb and with the current Board of Supervisors that it was not being moved to asset to be competitive. It was being moved to asset simply based on the fact that that was a simpler model. So we're grateful. Last year it looked like we asked for an extra $283,000, but in fact those were simply just direct funds from the county that we were moving to the asset process. So we're grateful for the support. We're grateful for all that you guys do. And I'm going to turn it over to Jerry.
Before you leave, because I don't want to forget, I have a question coming back to kind of where you started talking about similar model for crisis stabilization for youth.
Yep.
Okay. And then you were talking about plans for a new addiction center, and then you were looking at behavioral health campus.
Yeah.
Are we talking about all of this being, in your vision, one facility?
Yeah, different buildings on the same campus. So the addiction treatment program will run independent of the shelter and the crisis services. But I really see right now it sometimes takes 2 weeks. A family will call in crisis with a kid who needs treatment, substance abuse treatment. It takes 2 weeks sometimes to get them the support. And so I see a continuum where we use that crisis stabilization to get the kids stable. They may or may not need treatment, and then they could be referred to treatment.
Well, I know that's been the discussion since I came on the board. You and the previous employee of yours had talked about it a couple times.
Yeah.
Okay. So now my follow-up was into the $5.5 million.
Yeah.
That's what you're envisioning raising to create this campus for all three services, correct?
Yeah, that's what we're testing. That's what we're testing.
Okay.
Right now.
All right. I was unsure if that was plus $5.5 million on top of
that. No, that would replace the houses that we have, our shelter and our addiction treatment program. That would replace those. Those would become like transitional houses for like halfway houses.
Thanks, Andrew.
Was it the housing that was going to be separate or the treatment that was going to be separate or both?
The shelter will be separate from the treatment on the campus.
Okay, so people housed there for treatment would be housed separately.
Yes.
People housed, okay.
Separate from shelter. They're both residential facilities, so they're both overnight, staff 24/7, would take advantage of shared services. Right now, all three of our residential programs do food differently, right? They don't use shared resources. They've all got to find their own gym time. They've all got to do, you know, a lot of things that are just not really efficient, plus the need of the kids that we're seeing right now. It just doesn't make sense to have a low IQ kid who has been abused in the same shelter facility as an older boy that, you know, maybe has abused kids.
I have a quick question for you then. Surprisingly, it's going to be a Medicaid question for you. So did you get things all resolved with AmeriHealth?
We don't know for
okay.
sure.
Because I know I think they're closing everything
yep.
up at
the
end
very,
of this month. Or,
very
so I just want to make sure on that.
Yeah.
And then I'm assuming I know you'll be on top of her.
United
as well.
Right. Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah, we expect that United still owes us several hundred thousand dollars. I hope that it gets paid. I think most of AmeriHealth did get paid.
So, okay, great.
Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Letting me know, though.
I'll, in general, just look forward to, I look at so many experts in the room, and I'm not the expert here, but how this children's mental health sorts out and how the counties are going to be allowed or restricted given the mental health. You know, build up as I think about that crisis center, because I know that was an issue, is kind of was just being batted around. And, well, the county had a building to give for the adult one. So.
Yeah, and I think that at the end of the day, let's rely on Medicaid funding, right, because there's a federal match as much as we can, but know that in order to provide the quality services, it actually costs more. We get like $160 a day to provide substance abuse treatment for Medicaid. Cost me $250. A day, so I lose $100 per day per kid. Similar with shelter, shelter gets $146 a day. Some of that is paid for by you, but the county has a piece of that, and it costs us closer to $200 a day. So we sign contracts to lose money all the time. But let me just say how excited I am for the sitting board. When I did this 3 years ago, it was a completely different makeup. So I see three champions for kids. I see three champions for mental health, and really, really excited about the future for Story County. So let me turn it over to my staff.
Thank you.
Jerry.
Thank you.
You provide support. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jerry. We gave you a pretty lengthy report. I don't know, since most of you are new to the board this year, I don't know if you need me to explain some of the programs or if you have specific questions for the programs. It's a busy, busy summer right now with hundreds of kids in our Kids Club programs and our summer enrichment programs. This is a partner. The summer enrichment is a partnership with United Way, the school districts, and it really has developed over the years. And this year, Ames Schools made the decision that every one of their summer services should be available to every child, no matter whether they can pay for it or not. So the enrichment program went from 120 kids to close to 400 kids. So busy, busy week. It's only a three-week program, so Friday, woo! But, yeah, I think it's worked out well. Felicia's going to talk a little bit about mentoring, and then I wanted to share some things about the Iowa Youth Survey, which the county just survey just came out. So let Felicia
that's
talk.
Small one. That is a small one. Oh, good. Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear me?
My name is Felicia Watkins. I'm the mentoring program manager for Riot Fest. Our program in Story County partners with five school districts. We have a school-based program as well as a community-based program. Our community-based program serves the Riot Fest residential treatment program. Typically, for mentoring, we serve anywhere between 150 to 250 youth throughout the school year. And we're pretty excited that our program is celebrating 20-year anniversary this year. Since 1999, we've served over 8,000 youth. And we're really going to take the opportunity this year to celebrate our impact, raise awareness of the program. Right now we're working on implementing a recruitment and marketing plan to help us reduce the waiting list. Another exciting thing that we did this year is we started a Life Fest Mentoring Advisory Council, which all of you are most invited to join us with. We will meet every quarter. This really has given our program stakeholders an opportunity to give ongoing feedback to the program, assist with our sustainability plan, and just be actively engaged in moving the program forward. So we have a lot of great mentors in our program that are connected in many different ways to the community, so they have become a great resource for us to make sure that we can continue to reduce our waiting list and actually get things for the county.
And you're also welcome to become a mentor if you are not, since we do have a waiting list.
I'm still working on my husband because I know
good.
You so need male.
We really do.
Yeah, so
good.
I want you to know, every time I see this, when I saw the report, I said to him again, you would be so good at this because he's a teacher.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the Iowa Youth Survey comes out every 2 years, and it schools can or can choose not to participate in it, but it asks 6th, 8th, and 11th graders some questions about behavior, their risky behavior, and what they're doing. And some of it, with our Kids Club programs and our mentoring programs and our summer programs, we're seeing more and more kids with behavior issues. And one of the questions on the Iowa Youth Survey is, in the last 30 days, has a teacher had to stop teaching to deal with behavior problems? And that just shot up this since last year, 2 years ago. And it's been a steady increase, particularly in all grades, but every grade, 6th, 8th, 11th grade, has seen an increase. up to 10% increase. So that's pretty, you know, kids are drinking less, they're binging less. And that's a national trend, actually, also. And we're seeing it in Story County, which is great. Marijuana and smoking are holding their own, unfortunately. Gambling is increasing, particularly among girls, which is kind of an interesting trend. And we're also seeing the female population vaping more, using marijuana more, smoking more. So girls are taking much more risky behavior, which is of concern. Suicide is the one I because we've been asked by schools to help them address this, but according to the Iowa Youth Survey, where the kids are asked, and this is 11th graders, reported that they had a plan to kill themselves in the last 12 months. And that has gone up from 10% in 2016 to 22% in 18. It was pretty steady until this last 2 years, which is frightening.
And how many months in the last? Question
12 here. Months in the last year
in the last
have you had
year,
a plan?
22%?
Mm-hmm. Of the 11th graders in Story County that answered that.
And how many schools did you get responses from, Jerry?
I think the only school that does not participate is Gilbert.
Okay.
This is Story County. This is
right,
Story
right,
County.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, I believe Gilbert continues to be the only one that does not.
Are they, on the survey, are they asked kind of why or asked for circumstantial or narrative?
No, not really. The other one that struck me is how the 11th graders felt they had more access to handguns than in the past. Also, and you know, the drugs, marijuana, will make them more popular. More kids are agreeing with that statement. What was the other one I thought? Oh, the bullying. That bullying kind of came down, but it's on its way back up about kids who feel that they were bullied at school in the last 30 days, made called names, made fun of, teased in a hurtful way. And that's all grades increasing in 11th grade, which is kind of interesting. But it's available online. I didn't want to make copies for you, but there's some interesting data about kids, so we're trying to look at that to see where our services go forward, what we can do in terms of mental health prevention and bullying prevention and some of that.
So I know at Juvenile Justice Committee, one of the meetings last spring or when the superintendent of the schools was there, and she talked about how they were actually taking general fund dollars starting this school year to put into behavioral type course services, sound like prevention. So have you guys been able to already work with them to figure out what you're going to be offering? It sounded like they were going to bring YSS
in
to help.
We've been in talks with the curriculum director who's leaving this week. So
of course.
But I know that they're very interested in broader training, like Nurtured Heart for all schools and parents, and doing some of that broad-based training. So we're working on getting our people certified. So
that's bold. To take your general fund dollars that way. But it's exciting.
Well, the superintendent is from a community that was doing great things in mental health, children's mental health, and so she was very disappointed in. She's going to make change, which is great. Great. We need it. So thank you. Any more questions?
I have some questions about prevention and targeting prevention versus the general scattered kind of thing, but I think it's fairly a complex question, so maybe I'll just talk with you about that sometime later.
I do
feel like there are some, you know, that in times maybe when, you know, when funds aren't there to just do the scattered prevention to everybody. We've got to think about how we get the best use of
prevention. Universal or targeted, those are the prevention
terms. Those are the terms. Let's, and I won't,
Yeah, I'd like to.
I'd like to talk about that some more sometime.
Okay.
Thank you.
I just want to acknowledge Monday, Jerry will have been with YSS for 19 years. One other agency, she could run an agency if she wanted to. She could have had my job probably if she wanted to. She's an expert in her space, and she's really looked at that across the state. So thanks to Jerry. And she's also created an environment where someone like Felicia, how have you been with us for
4 years
total, but there was a gap in this. So she came to work for us. She left because she found a job that paid her more. And shortly thereafter, she came back because she understood just how committed we are to this work. So I don't ever like to lose people, but I love it when I lose someone and they come back. So
well, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Terry Johansson, and I've been with YSS for just under 30 years. I'm part of the woodwork now, and know a lot, but know so little some days. Anyway, I just want to thank you for your support throughout the years. Been before the Board of Supervisors many, many times, and just want you to know how meaningful it is to receive your support, and not only on a financial basis, but we feel the emotional support and the connection to the Board of Supervisors, and of course that's the support to our county and our kids and families. So want to thank you on the front end for that. I'm the Associate Vice President for our Child Welfare and our Transition Services at YSS. And I brought Emily Revoloso today because she's newer to her role. She started in January but has been with YSS for 10 years plus. And another retained staff that we're really excited to have her promoted into the Child Welfare Emergency Services Program Director role. And that means a lot of things, but on any given day, she's providing all the direct oversight of our Rosedale shelter in Ames and also that partnership and leadership with our shelter in Mason City at Francis Lauer location. And Emily's going to provide a little bit of information about our trends and what we're seeing at Story County related. For those of you who may not know, we're available to serve the whole state of Iowa, but really have been carved out to serve the Des Moines service area with our Rosedale shelter and the northern service area with our Mason City shelter, which are the DHS regions that are carved out depending upon where facilities are located. And since we're in Story County, we do serve a lot of Polk County youth that tend to be overflow youth that need to be served in that area because of the volume and only one shelter available in the Des Moines area. So we tend to be that overflow, but we also say that we tend to be the niche for those kids that don't make it in other places. And I think that's because of our home environment, home-like environment. It's a double-edged sword sometimes as to what the environment can provide or not provide with the kids coming and going. But with the trauma that we see, the kids coming into our shelter today, some of the challenging behaviors that are displayed, just the environment alone and the nurturing nature of our staff really does provide that connection to kids in a way that makes sense and makes a difference to the families and the kids. Our Story County support that you all provide and have provided for years really helps us to focus on diversion. Diversion from the system, that being DHS and JCS, but also serving the kids who are within the system, within Story County. We've just seen over the years that our diversion services are continuing to increase on a local level. That's a good thing because diversion services mean that
placement services are going to be much shorter than a system-involved kid that's already involved with DHS or juvenile court services. So overall, we're seeing an increase in our diversion services for our non-system families, those families that aren't entrenched in the system, and that's something that Emily's going to share a little bit more about. So I think I'll turn it over to you, Emily, and just really appreciate Emily's leadership, and she's been doing a great job, hit the ground running, and was already in the shelter environment when she was promoted, so we're excited to have her on board and carry on the traditions and all the great services that are happening at Rosedale Shelter. So there you go.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the biggest trends that we're seeing that Andrew kind of touched on about is the increased mental health and behavior needs. It's on the news every single day. Does that mean that you kick that off?
No. You have a lot of impact.
Right. Yeah, the they're just making it more challenging. And with our contract obligations with DHS, we cannot eject or reject a child based on those needs. So we're really having to invest in staffing higher ratios. We just finished our renovation to Rosedale, the first floor, really invested in opening up that space, better line of sight for staff, closed off entryway. So before you would enter, you entered right to the space. It wasn't as probably secure, so we've added that space as well, and closed off the kitchen. And so we're trying to meet the ever-changing needs as they continue to increase. And while our actual overall number of youth served at this point is a little lower, we're being more creative with the way that we help the families with diversion. So a few families we've been able to extend a few more days. We had a local girl who, she needed a week, and typically we do 1 to 2 days, but there was some family that was coming to town and could help and take her. So we kept her in shelter for a week, which is not a typical type of service, but kind of worked with that family because we knew it was better. We knew she'd make it to school. We keep her in school. And so we're just trying to be a little bit more creative and flexible to help keep those kids diverted any way that we can. And so while the number might be lower, we might see an actual increase in the number of days than their stays.
Yeah, I don't know if you have questions from the shelter perspective, and I could go on and on about statewide shelter themes and trends, but really wanted to focus on Story County. I think the important thing is that, as Andrew said earlier, we are going to kick off a crisis stabilization program that the county is supporting up in Mason City at our shelter. We'll be coordinating, collaborating heavily with our family therapists and our clinicians in the Mason City area so that we're providing a good package to those youth coming into the shelter for that crisis stabilization piece and working on that reunification and wrapping services around those families so we can divert them from the system and really work on meet them where they're at and provide the services that are necessary to meet their mental health needs. So we're excited about kicking that off in Mason City and using that model, learning from that model to move towards hopefully implementing that program at Rosedale Shelter. We do see the need. The need has been there for a long time. I think now that there is a mental health system being created for children and youth that's specifically there to help meet their needs, we're going to be able to be there and be there to support them in a different way going forward as well. So we are excited about that opportunity and hope to have more conversation with y'all about that moving forward.
Other questions?
In some ways, it sounded like for several years that your shelters have served as de facto crisis stabilization facilities anyway. So I want to thank you and all of your staff for that. As I was before kind of you guys came on board and I was more listening to more of this discussion and hanging with Andrew, et cetera, and it became very, very clear that youth and teens experience the crisis different, may get much more agitated more quickly and then come down more quickly, all kinds of differences that aren't adults. Right. And so I think you guys have borne a lot of, and I don't want to say burden, but that's the word that came out, borne a lot of rolling with the punches to serve a population that had your needs, that had the need and you were there. So thank you for that for many years.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that insight. Thank you.
And thank you to Terry, 30 years, and Emily for stepping up being promoted.
Yeah. I do have one quick question.
Yeah.
The no reject, no eject policy. Mm-hmm. I've always kind of assumed that you did have potential to, if you had a child that just was needed more, that you could get them into some inpatient on a temporary basis. But you don't even have Mary Greeley with
no.
children's
no, we,
beds
No, we
anymore.
Have very, very few options. And when Emily was talking about stepping up our staffing patterns, that truly is out of the need for safety.
I'm sure.
And making sure that we're wrapping enough staff and resources around those kids and youth as they're coming in with multiple layers of trauma and mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we don't even get the information on the front end to know what we're really dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to be able to staff up quickly and make sure that we're doing the interventions on site as quick as possible.
So if you
really actually sees us as the intervention.
Yeah,
right.
They do.
They do.
Right.
Okay.
They're social workers and they say we don't have the relationships to go where all the other places we can send them are full. We'll take a kid in crisis there even and they'll be in the back saying you're 24 hours. You can watch them. And so even if their needs are too high, we are still.
Yeah, we used to have it really as an option, at least the psychiatric unit.
Sure,
that
then they closed the bed. I know. So I'm still thinking there must be like a less, just ever, like you've got a child who's acting out who you cannot control physically. You've got to call law enforcement then, don't you?
Yeah, and so we have been partnering the best we can with law enforcement.
Yeah.
They have been great.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. When they come, we give them this is kind of where we're at, and they know our no eject, no reject policy as well. Juvenile court has come alongside us as well to try to help support
good.
Some of those intense behavior needs. But no, there
used to be something called a 10-day, or maybe there's still is.
Yes,
you could give a 10-day notice to DHS that in 10 days you've got to find another placement for this kid. But I'll say this. 2.5 months ago, we brought in a 10-year-old boy who was on the autism spectrum who broke a dozen windows the first day he was there, put his hand through a wall or a foot through a wall almost every day. And we were not, because there was no place for him to go, 10 days was not even an option.
Mm-hmm.
So for 2 months, we had to staff up, and we had to fix walls, and we had to repair plaster, and we had to, you know, try to accommodate the need. And at the end of the day, he was probably best taken care of at Rosedale by the staff in his home-like environment. But at $146 a day or whatever it is, it just doesn't pay for the level of services that he needs.
The damages were over $4,000. We were totaling them. We're not But his last week before he went to his higher level of care, which the highest level actually, a lot of the units were denying him because he was too intense. He finally got into somewhere. And the last week he was there, he stabilized. Not the only thing.
We say that was his badge of honor, but it was staff's badge of honor as well, but certainly his. And thank God he could leave the facility on a good note like that and start treatment at a level and a baseline of I'm feeling stable.
And one of the reasons I wanted to bring this question up is I don't think that the general public understands the difficult situations that your staff deal with and what great people they are to go back day after day and deal with those situations. You're doing a wonderful job, and I just wanted to kind of highlight that.
I really appreciate it. There's no way we get this job done without the staff that we have. Turnover is an issue because this is really hard work, but you've got four folks here who committed their life to this work because they know the impact. The new space that we're looking at, this campus that in a rural sort of environment, is really important for this level of care because we don't lock our doors. We're not a locked facility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So right now, a kid can walk out the door and essentially go across the street to Fairway and just get what they want, right? So we need a more rural sort of setting. So when a kid walks out the door, staff's with them, and they go for a walk along our trail through some trees as opposed to into the neighbor's yard or the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I'll just say is I got a text from a kid. I attend all the residential treatment graduations because that's the program that saved my life in the mid-90s. And I encourage all of them by saying, hey, you know what, you stay sober a day at a time, you could become the next CEO of ISS, you could go on to help a lot of people. Today our relationship changes from two people, from CEO client to two people in recovery, staying sober one day at a time. And I got a text just about 4 weeks ago from a kid. He said, what's up, man? I'm feeling and doing great, man. I ended up going to a meeting Friday night as well as Sunday and yesterday. I'm headed home right now, just had dinner with a family. I interview and have a welding test tomorrow. I'll tell you what, this is a 17-year-old kid, sober 3 months, out of treatment for a week. I'll tell you what, man, I never thought I could feel or be this happy or enjoy life this much. So that's why we do what we do. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
And you have somebody else reporting here?
Nope.
A great report.
Thank you.
With all the numbers of kids that you served last year, yeah, you deserve this time to give a report on.
Yeah, really commendable what you do.
You know, if I could just say one last praise, okay, for the staff at YSS, and I want to talk about Denise Denton. I was on the Board of Health. Now Lisa's going on for me instead, but Denise, over the years, has shown up at the Board of Health meetings every other month and brought pertinent, current information about a variety of topics related to youth, teens, and adults, obviously, and mental health and chemical dependency and whatever, and has kept the Board of Health very informed and has started some conversations that I think some will move forward. So I just want you to know that your staff in a variety of different job positions have made impact. So,
and I'm going to make him get back to work now.
And you folks make him get back to work.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. We appreciate the information.
Thank you.
Now we'll hear from Keith Morgan with Emergency Management. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning. Don't mind, I'll just go ahead and jump right on into it.
Okay.
Emergency Management Agency response activity has been relatively light compared to the rest of the state. Common thread has been hazmat. Two of the hazmat incidences were associated with vehicle operations, and one was due to a suspicious package right here in the administrative building. Even though the suspicious package here in the building were found to be harmless, all the response agencies indicated that there were enough identifiers on the packages to justify the response. The employee's response shows the value of the training that we did at the safety day last year, and I hope we continue those kind of activities. Severe weather monitoring continues to be one of our activities, and on Saturday, this last Saturday, we actually recommended the activation of outdoor warning sirens to the south of Ames due to 72-mile-an-hour winds indicated at the Ames Airport. So that was in accordance with standard operating guidance that we have. Any questions on our responses? Okay. Moving on, as usual, our office continues to revise plans. And as mandated by Iowa code, we have to revise 20% of our plans every year. The final two that we're working on right now are ESF2 Emergency Support Function 2, which is communications, and ESF15, which is public information, both of which are absolutely critical during our emergency responses. The deputy coordinator has been working with one of your interns, Alex Lamone, and she's working real hard, the intern is, to try and teach us old dogs new tricks when it comes to social media. But social media is one of those things that will be, again, a tool for us to communicate with our public and also for us to learn from the public what they're hearing much better than through 911 systems and through the media. So we're working on that, and I encourage the board to also consider what your emergency communications plans are going to look like, how you're going to integrate your press releases, your social media releases, and all of that so that you can give the public the information that they need right away, because that can set the tone for a response in a positive or a negative fashion right away.
We've also had to be doing some out-of-cycle plan revisions, and we've been working on our I-35 closure plan. It seems odd with temperatures getting up to 84 today that we take ourselves back to the I-35 closure, which lasted for a day and a half. And from that, we have a lot, not a lot, but two main areas that we're working on. First off is parking within Ames. And we started a dialogue with Ames and Iowa State to better to conform our parking to what the truckers need. So we are discussing, again, with Iowa State, interactions with sporting events, and also with local businesses to see where we might possibly be able to have truckers stay closer to the fuel and closer to services. In addition, we're working with the Iowa DOT to get messaging out to these truckers. In fact, we're going to try and tell them to please don't come on up this way if I-35 is closed, because we do have such limited diesel refueling points here and also parking. So that's a two-prong approach that we're working on. It takes quite a bit of time to bring all the players in the same place at the same time, but we'll work on that all the way through the summer, and next October when we run this drill, hopefully we will have the plan modified to meet our needs better. Another off-cycle planning effort that we've had to be working with is the schools. Recent changes to Iowa code have mandated the schools have high-quality emergency operations plans to include targeted planning on active shooter and also natural disasters. We've been working with our local schools here to bring together them and first responders to truly integrate our responses and to even get them to work amongst themselves to ensure the resources are in the right place at the right time should something happen. They had to approve those plans by June 30th. So now the real key will be taking those plans and practicing them with training and exercises to convert those words into a true capability. As mentioned above, training exercises are the key to translating plans into capabilities. And our office participated with the Sheriff's Office on their abduction training that they do annually. We got together with them and tried to relay to them what we can and cannot do at times as emergency management to assist them in this. And also, we tried to get a better understanding of what law enforcement procedures will be during one of these incidences so we can anticipate their needs and meet them as quickly as possible. In parallel with the sheriff's training, our Star One, our search and rescue team, hosted bringing in an expert on an abduction training for a two-day training course on the subject. It was attended by folks from both sheriff's office, Ames PD, and other local agencies around here. Very interesting training that highlighted a lot of things, and a side effect from that was that we became aware of online mapping tools that could assist us both in an abduction and also in just situational awareness should we have a large-scale disaster. I'm working with Matt Boyk here from our GIS department and Ames GIS to see how we might integrate this into an incident command structure should there be a disaster. It parallels our efforts that we've been doing with Matt to make it so that we can send him out to be side-by-side with an incident commander to gather information and give everybody situational awareness through pictures, which is much more efficient than just speaking back and forth. So we'll be continuing those efforts in the future. Supervisor Merton knows, we finally got our jurisdictional executive workshop put together on the fourth try. I thought it was very useful, and as jurisdictional executives, it's very important that you all understand what your position is going to be, what you should be doing, and again, what you should not be doing during a disaster. And our workshop, which tried to bring other jurisdictional executives together, worked pretty good in opening a discussion on how we'll be integrating our efforts across the different jurisdictions. Our new supervisor, ma'am, I look forward to getting with you and giving you a little bit more background. I know we've had a chance to talk about emergency management before, but our first hour that we set up turned into a couple of hours. So whenever your schedule frees up, we'd love to discuss your role and the great support we've been having from Story County to the commission. And some of the best education comes from looking back at our past events. And our recent combined meeting with the Local Emergency Planning Commission and also our Business Resiliency Committee, where we brought in Steve Juan, who is safety for Vermeer. As you might remember, Vermeer took a direct hit from not one, but multiple EF3 tornadoes. And if I had written an exercise scenario where they would have 400 people from an international community there when those tornadoes hit, and also make it during shift change, they would have thrown me out of the room, but that's what happened. And through some fantastic planning, through training and exercises, by putting together safe rooms, they managed to protect all of those people with only 8 minor injuries, and also get the company up and running very quickly after the disaster. It's an example of, again, how we can't do everything for everybody. Businesses, government, and us all need to work together to be as best prepared as possible. And I think by bringing those lessons learned from Vermeer, I think hopefully we'll be setting some businesses on track to be more self-sustaining should we have a large-scale disaster. So I'll offer an opportunity if anybody has any questions about those activities.
Questions? Thanks, Keith. And yes, I did make a notation to make sure I emailed you to set up a meeting time frame.
Thank you.
And we'll block out a couple hours on that. So I did have a question on particularly like the school training that you referenced, and that mm-hmm. it sounds like you'll be doing some exercises as well. So did the school determine who is part of that committee? Are you only working with like the staff, the personnel, you know, like the superintendent, or are there other families involved?
The way that we worked with the schools is there is a template that is a nationally recognized template on how to put together a school plan. I took that template and I invited them to come down, all the school districts to come down and have a meeting so that I could give them some ideas behind what that template meant. And in fact, in areas I highlighted in red, this is one way you might do it, but you as a school district have to put it together. Then some of the school districts, Colonesco was outstanding. As you know, they have split operations up in Zering and also down in Colo. And they had two separate meetings where they invited the fire chief, Story County Sheriff's, who was their law enforcement, and even the city administration to come together and discuss plans, which was absolutely phenomenal in identifying that what looks good on paper, when we really got discussing, we made some modifications to those plans. So it was up to the schools and the school districts on how they did that. I also worked with the Ames school system, and just at the beginning of this month, we had a meeting again with fire and law enforcement as they worked through it.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions?
And Keith, I'm not sure if this would go to you, or I'm going to turn to Deb Shildroth in the back of the room, but one of the things that, as we're talking about the COOP COG, or we're talking about emergency planning from some exercises we've had prior to this particular board being seated, is that looking at jurisdictional powers. You had the jurisdictional mm-hmm. workshop, but then there are some actual motions at the table to approve some jurisdictional powers, et cetera. And I was kind of wondering where that stood. As I said, I just kind of asked Deb to take that down to the various planning activities with you guys. So
I'll let Deb speak
to that. Okay, I'm sorry. I know it's kind of an awkward one to have her come up too, but with transition happening very quickly, so that would be something that we all probably should track.
Yeah, there were a couple of documents that you had provided to me, and I passed them on to the COOP
COG. Okay. All right.
Looking at modifications and changes
with the COOP COG. Okay, I think. And then, Keith, are you involved with the COOP COG with that at some point also?
Yeah, we work together all the time. A lot of times they'll do work on their own as an advisor to all of the jurisdictions. I give them input and some ideas, options on how to look at it, and oftentimes those jurisdictions will go back and look at those different options and modify them to meet their needs. So anytime that there's a requirement or that they have questions, it's best just pick up the phone and give me a call.
Okay. So turning to the board, just to kind of emphasizing that while we've got work being done on the COOP COG committee itself, which is if we have to move operations, some of these would be applicable even if we had a major disaster in the county and had to pick up jurisdictional. So I guess we just kind of note your emergency management and on the board living here or whatever. If do we want to wait for a COOP COG committee, if it's going to be a long time before they get back?
Why don't you send us the documents so we can look at them? I've not seen them.
I'll have to go find them. They came from Melissa Spencer originally. So,
okay.
so I will go locate them. Okay. And okay. Leanne, you have them, right? Because they were referred on. Okay. Oh, got it.
And maybe Leanne, you could forward those to Lisa and myself.
That sounds good.
Thank you.
I just didn't want it to kind of.
Well, yeah, I'd like to know. Yeah, before I get into the conversation, I'd like to see the documents and know a little bit more about what the issue is.
Sure.
Okay. And additionally, as a follow-on to that, there are two aspects. The Coop Cog was primarily an inward-looking focus on how do you get your operations back up and running to support the rest of the county. As mentioned, you also need to consider how you would handle, for instance, a large-scale train derailment out in the county itself. So where you are working with an incident commander out there to support the citizens. So two separate parts that you need to consider.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. Go ahead.
Okay. Exercise tests and planning. Again, it seems like a long time ago, but back in March, we did the statewide tornado drill where we worked with the National Weather Service to exercise the process of notification of a tornado warning through activation of the sirens. And the test went fairly well. We had 42 out of 45 sirens activate. But we are hoping that with the new communication system, which relies on the pagers to activate these sirens, that on that end of it, we will get a system that is much more robust and much more refined on making sure that the sirens activate. After that's done, it's up to the jurisdictions themselves to ensure that their sirens, the hardware, work within their own communities. Operationally, we continue to engage with the Iowa Pork Producers Association to monitor and plan for the possibility of African swine fever coming to North America. As a part of our preparations, I had discussions with the Board of Health, and we talked about their role should something like this happen and our counties need to be able to react to this. As Iowa Code 163.17 points to the Board of Health to be the primary point of contact should a foreign animal disease outbreak occur. And it's going to involve more than the Board of Health. It will involve many county resources and assets to include the jurisdictions throughout the county need to be prepared to respond to this should we have this happen. We also exercised our command and communications trailer just this weekend, as a matter of fact. We had the Story County Amateur Radio Emergency Services, ARES, one of our great partners, go out there and use it for the 24-hour field test. They use the trailer to conduct their operations, doing things such as running our generator to see how long it'll operate on a tank of gas, which we didn't know up until this time, and to conceptualize how that trailer might be used to support incident command, especially on the communications. And they gave us some great ideas, which we are going to translate into the upcoming Buy-4 radios. We need to be able to make sure that that trailer is optimized to work in whatever conditions, no matter how remote, during a disaster. So any questions on those operations? So finally, looking ahead, again, we will be continuing to monitor the weather to provide information, as much information as possible, both to the public, to event organizers, and decision makers, so they can reduce their risk to severe weather. As you know, Rick Sanders has left us, and as our board representative to the Emergency Management Commission, he was also the chair. So at our next meeting, which is about 3 weeks from now, we'll have to elect new officers for the Emergency Management Commission.
Okay, I'm going back up. You said as the board rep, he was the chair. I thought that all the mayors voted.
He was one representative, and all the commission voted for him to be the chair. So
right.
It can be any mayor, it could be the sheriff, or it could be the commission or the county's representative on the board.
Okay, thank you.
With the new fiscal year, our office moves back into our planning mode again. And this year, we're going to be looking at our transportation, our public works, logistics, energy, and again, the hazmat plan like we do every year. So we'll be diving deep into those, revising them, making them better, and updating them. Another important effort of our office is going to try to streamline our training and exercise activities. While we'd like to provide every jurisdiction out there very personalized attention, we are definitely running out of the resources to do that. So So our efforts are going to be is to try and bring the jurisdictions together to optimize when we do have planning and exercising, having an exercise that's applicable to all the jurisdictions there. So again, there can be interaction between them so they can learn from everybody, and we can make more, maybe not as often, but better quality exercises and training events that will serve the needs across the entire county. So that's going to be one of our primary efforts, and we're going to need the assistance of all the agencies to tell us what their needs are and to work with us to optimize our calendar in this coming year so that we can work smarter and not harder. So with that, I leave it open to any other questions you might have.
I have none.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Keith, very much.
Thank you.
So moving on, consideration of minutes. We have minutes from June 11th and June 18th. I would entertain a motion for approval.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion?
No.
Not? Olson?
Aye.
Hiddens?
Aye.
Minutes are approved. Thank you. Next, consideration of personnel actions. There are actions listed on the agenda. I would entertain a motion for approval of the actions as listed.
I make the motion to approve the, what is it, the pay adjustment?
Personnel action.
Personnel actions.
Okay. I second.
Okay. Hiddens?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Okay, Merkin, aye. Next is consideration of claims. I would entertain a motion for approval of claims as listed.
I'll make a motion to approve the claims as listed.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, any discussion? Not Hiddens?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye. Then we move on to the consent agenda. Again, does anybody want to pull any items from the consent agenda?
No.
If not, then I would entertain a motion for approval.
I'll move that we approve as presented.
I'll second.
Okay. Olson?
Aye.
Hiddens?
Aye.
Okay. Consent agenda. Merkin, aye. I think I missed one before. I voted on it. I just didn't say it. Okay. Thank you very much.
She's an aye.
She's got it. Okay. Then we'll move on to public hearing items, and we have Amelia Sherman to discuss the second consideration of Ordinance 283.
Okay. So this one was the Westwood Center rezoning minor subdivision and C2C plan amendment. At your meeting last week, you approved the C2C amendment and the minor subdivision plat. And so this is the second consideration of the ordinance to rezone the parcel from A1 agricultural to AR. And so we have received no additional comments from the public or no additional information to be provided to you all. So with that, staff typically doesn't go through the presentation again unless there's more questions or you want us to. Okay. And so the alternative that staff would be recommending would be approval of the ordinance as put forth on second consideration with waiving of the third consideration, and it's typical for rezonings.
Any questions then? If not, I'll open the public hearing. Does a member of the public want to address this issue? Seeing nobody move to the microphone, I will close the public hearing and entertain a motion for approval on second consideration of the ordinance and waiving third consideration.
I'll move approval of the second consideration of Ordinance 283 and waive the third.
I second.
Okay. Any further discussion? Hiddens?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye. Thank you, Amelia.
Thank you.
Okay. Now we're on to additional items and discussion and consideration of insurance review. Steve Goodhue and her team. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Steve Goodhue with Napton Nest Insurance. Appreciate the opportunity to be on the agenda this morning. I'll be joined very shortly here by Andrew Brickless from our office, and Susan Hosher also looks with this relationship. Might provide a little bit of background for the supervisor of Head and Benefit. We were here just about a year ago, August of last year, to do the annual review, and at that time talked about some proposed deductible changes with the county's relationship. The supervisor also asked us to come back with a market analysis to look at the carriers and determine if we're with the right carriers, the county's with the right carriers, are the premium price right, competitive. So we came back in February of last year and did a market analysis and looked at coverages, looked at premiums, looked at rates. And from that meeting, we concluded that really all the lines of coverages are with the right carriers, the price competitively, perhaps with the exception of one line, that was the property portion of the county's insurance relationship. The board directed us at that time to market it, quote it out, if you will, and we're going to show you some slides as we look at further in the presentation. What we did, we're also going to suggest and recommend some different deductible alternatives today as well. So if we go to the next slide, Supervisor Hedden, for your benefit, the county is insured with ICAP, the Iowa Community Insurance Pool. Everything except what comp is there. About 75% of the county are insured with ICAP throughout the state, and they insure several cities as well. I think they work with about 800 municipalities and all the related entities. And as you'll see when we get to the final slide, one of the benefits of ICAP that they provide is called premium voucher discount, if you will. It's about $29,000 a year, which is really a nice benefit that you normally wouldn't receive from another carrier. And then the work comp is with the Iowa Municipal Workers' Compensation Association. They insure 71 counties. They also provide some terrific credits. And you'll see that when you get to the end, about $281,000 of credits that go back to the county to make that work comp price very competitively. Now we take just a couple minutes, and we'll move fairly quickly through these, just to look at some claim activity. Claims drive premium. Right or wrong, they oftentimes drive premium. And so we think it's important to just take a step back and look at where the claim's been over the past 5 years. Oftentimes this can help board and staff also drive training initiatives. But I'll just roll through these fairly quickly. And these are work comp claims. I'll show you a chart in a minute that's just related to non-work comp. But these are work comp claims by frequency over the past 5 years. You'll see the color variation and the number of claims in parentheses beyond that. For example, 13 I claims over the past 5 years, 2 I claims, 25 slip and fall, and so on. You'll see that the largest portion of that is the miscellaneous, and I'll break that down as we go a little bit further. But no real trends there to speak of as you look at the first slide over the past 5 years. Second slide shows by dollar amount. So then we break down those claims and say, okay, of those 13 I claims, what was the cost or what sort of claims were paid out over the past 5 years? And you'll see as an example about $5,200 in I claims, $494 in bike claims, and so on. Slip and falls can be a little bit of an expensive claim at times to pay out. Sometimes there's physical therapy and things of that related, but you'll see about $130,000. Not a lot of expenditure when it comes to overexertion and cuts. And then miscellaneous, which we're going to break down in a minute, is the largest or the second largest at $125,000. Here's the miscellaneous work comp claim. So again, we're going to break down that largest piece by frequency, and you'll see it ranges from outdoor rashes to burns, exposure to bodily fluids, not at fault car accidents. That's uninsured, underinsured motors who perhaps one of our employees or county employees are involved in. Largest piece of that is bumps, scrapes, tweaks, and that can happen in any occupation of the county for that matter. But no real trends, again, as you look there. Again, we're looking for is something greater than 30% or something approaching 50%, because, again, that might drive safety training for the county. And then here is miscellaneous work comp claims by dollar amount. The largest portion of that being training exercises, oftentimes related to police activities or sheriff's activities. I think the supervisor also has seen this before, and I believe Mertens as well. There were a couple claims there. You'll see there were 6 claims over the past 5 years. A couple of those were expensive claims. I think we've got a good handle on those. Todd is working very closely with the sheriff's department on training and trying to understand things that may have happened there in the past and how to react to those in the future. So, and those are the largest. Here's a trend line that shows the largest number of paid work comp claims over the past 5 years. You'll see that the county is very consistent, about 20 claims a year. But, you know, given the number of employees the county has, that's not unusual. We can probably look at other municipalities and find even greater numbers than that, but about 20 a year. And then this, our work comp incurred losses by year. I like to look at, okay, what is ICAP, or in this case, IMWC, paying out in the form of work comp losses. You see we have some trends and 2014-15 and begin in 2017-18. There is a large reserve in that large 2017-18 pie chart, if you will, of that 164,000. So there's still a claim that it's yet to be settled. I don't think we necessarily talked about that today. But then, as you move to 18-19, the year's not quite over. We've got a couple more days here, but a terrific year. Terrific year in terms of work comp claims and the management of those claims, getting people back, getting employees back to work. And that's a real tribute to Alyssa and her staff and Todd and the staff of all the department heads who, there is an incident, getting them back to work as quickly as possible before this paid time off. Certainly, we want to deal with those medical claims and get those in place. We want to go back to work as soon as possible. So, terrific here. And that leads to the flat chart, which is your experience modification rate. Supervisor Hedden, perhaps you've seen this rate before. This is really a function of your safety record, if you will. There's several things that go into this calculation, payroll and expected losses and that sort of thing. But the mod rate went up just a little bit this year. 0.74, 0.76. I'm going to tell you, 0.76 is still a terrific rate. But the baseline is 1.00. Ideally, a county, a city, any one insured, the experience concentration rate should be under 1.00. You go back to 2015, 16, 16, 17, the rate was even lower. There was more payroll at that time through community life services that factored into that. So once that payroll came off the county's payroll system, then the mod started to pick up a little bit. We had a little bit of pick up this past year due to some claims 2 years ago. But again, you're getting a 24% discount in your work comp premiums, and it's one of the best rates in the state. We oftentimes ask, we did ask this year, IMWCA, the county's experience mod rate is still one of the top 5 rates for counties in the state of Ohio. And then finally, here's a chart just showing property liability and auto claims over the past 5 years. So again, these are non-work comp claims, really not significant in any manner. 7 auto claims, a little less than 14,000. 3 liability claims, 237. The largest of the property claims is the new road for the Justice Center. It's about 400,000. I think that claim is close to being closed out, but not significant property claims either. So county has a terrific record when it comes to work comp and non-work comp claims. County does a very, very nice job.
We'll jump into the just the coverages today as it sits. So this first slide is just kind of a real quick high-level snapshot of what the ICAP policy, from a limit standpoint, how it sits today. Again, property, which I'll jump into a little bit later here. Property, you've got $67 million in property coverage throughout all your locations. From a liability standpoint, you've got $2 million on your liability in auto, law enforcement, public officials, and then another $13 million excess above that. So really what you have is $15 million in coverage from a liability standpoint. You'll notice quick too, on the deductible, as Steve mentioned earlier, what we're proposing today, and we'll explain why here, is a $50,000 deductible on the property. And we'll walk through the cost savings on that. And kind of, because again, last year you had $10,000 deductible on the property, and we're proposing a $50,000 deductible. So here's the property breakdown. So where does that $67 million come from? Here, it's $53 in building. We've got some personal property within those buildings, computers and equipment, and we got some scheduled property, and then some unscheduled property. So again, that comes out to be $67 million. Last year, it was at $63 million. So there was an increase of about just over $3 million in values. So here's your deductible comparison. So we, with ICAP, again, if we would have kept the deductible the same, the renewal would have came in at $107,000 this year. A $25,000 deductible would have been $94,000, and then the $50,000, which we're proposing, comes in at $80,000. So it's a $27,000 savings per year, which is significant in my mind, considering the deductible is only $40,000 difference. So then you're saying, okay, what out-of-pocket costs over the past 5 years? Well, with a $25,000 deductible, total out-of-pocket cost over that five-year period would have been $28,000 additional for the county. With the $50,000 deductible, total out-of-pocket cost would have been $53,000. So again, that's not per year, that's total. So about $10,000 a year additional cost with the higher deductible, yet you're saving $27,000 to go to the larger deductible. So So, and then we also mentioned during our market analysis that we were going to take the property piece out to a market. We came up with EMC Insurance and Cincinnati Insurance as markets. They all wanted to quote it. They all aggressively quoted it. Long story short, none of them were really close in pricing. Also, what it did help is we did tell ICAP we were pricing this out, which never hurts. So we did tell them we were going to shop it. We were going to shop it to other carriers. So they did come in very aggressively this year with their pricing. What you'll notice, too, that $72,000, that's different than the previous slide of $80,000. I took out the voucher percentage. I took out the voucher credit because I wanted to make sure it was apples to apples. Because if you move the property, you lose that voucher piece for the property premium. So I wanted to make sure it was apples to apples with EMC in Cincinnati. So I took the voucher credit off of this slide. But again, you can see there are some deductible differences too, but overall the pricing really, it's a great price for MICAP.
Here's a premium summary. We'll wrap up here and take some questions. But you'll see 17, 18, 18, 19 in the renewal this year. 244, which is $30,000 less than last year's pricing, is reflective of two things. It's reflective of a higher deductible, which we're going to recommend to you today, going from that $10,000 to the $50,000 deductible, and then as Andrew mentioned, just leveraging some other carriers and moving this pricing down where we think it should be. The IMWCA premium, $155,000, which is, again, a terrific renewal. They're offering up $281,000 worth of credits to renew that work comp premium, and that's even with increased payroll. So you'll see $155,107 there. Total premiums we're recommending for renewals, $399,431. About a $37,000 reduction, 9.5%. It's, from our perspective, a really good renewal, both on ICAP and IMWCA behalf. Again, the vouchers factored in, lots of more comp credits, and a higher deductible. And then one last thing we talked about with Chair Merkin and also staff is there is no flood on the policy today. Most of our commercial policies would have some element or some coverage, flood coverage, and so ICAP would offer that up. $2 million limit, 2% deductible for $2,000. The earthquake, many times earthquake comes along with flood, a much less expensive option. Not certain we would offer that or recommend that today, but at a minimum, you should look strongly at that $2,000 additional expense for flood insurance. In this county, it's important to have. We oftentimes recommend it very strongly to our clients. So, good renewal. We're very pleased to see ICAP and IMWCA come in where they did. Let's stop there and take questions.
Other questions?
None. Thank you. I'm glad that the analysis worked out to our benefit.
Yeah. Thanks for your recommendation. I think it worked well. We analyze it. It's transparent.
So there are two things to be considered here. One is if we go to a property deductible of $50,000 as opposed to our current $10,000, and the second is whether we want to take advantage of either those optional quotes, the flood or the earthquake. Do we want to discuss that, or does somebody want to make a motion? It's up to you.
I would make a motion that we accept the recommendation of going to a $50,000 deductible, staying with ICAP, adding the flood insurance for $2 million coverage at a 2% deductible with an additional cost of $2,000. So that would be a total premium then of $401,431 for this year.
And I would second that.
Your motion is second. Any further discussion? Okay. It's okay. Are you ready to vote?
I'm good.
Okay. Olson?
Aye.
Edmund?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye. Thank you very much. Consideration of Resolution 19-131.
So the budget, the FY20 budget starts in a few days. We put the budget together in March.
the in order to spend the dollars, the departments have to have the Board of Supervisors appropriate those dollars. So what you have in front of you is an appropriation resolution for FY20 budgeted dollars. I find it's important to get that done before the fiscal year starts so that we can pay people and stuff.
Kind of important.
Kind of important. What I've done, what I've presented to you is what I typically present, and I'm going to explain why. What we start the year with is usually a 50% appropriation for each department and elected official. The reason for that is because the cash flow situation, obviously we don't start collecting taxes until September, so it is prudent for us to not spend everything that's budgeted right up front. If there's any departments or elected officials that have special, you know, annual costs or anything like that, we can always adjust the appropriation a little bit if we need to. However, in order to keep our cash flowing nicely, we start with 50% to start the year, okay? The two exceptions to that are your general betterment account and your countywide services account. Those departments are both controlled by the Board of Supervisors, have a lot of large expenses ongoing, so I like to just go ahead and appropriate those dollars from the very beginning. So, do you have any questions?
I move adoption of Resolution 19-131.
Okay, second?
I second.
Okay, discussion? If not, we'll vote. Hedman?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye. Carried. Now you have another resolution.
So we also at budget time budgeted for transfers. Per the code, we transfer dollars to the secondary road fund from general fund and from rural services fund. That's how Secondary Roads gets their dollars. We also put some other things in the budget. We budgeted to transfer $600,000 to the supplemental fund, and we budgeted to transfer $160,000 to the TIF Urban Renewal Fund, from the TIF to the Urban Renewal Fund. At this point in time, as you'll notice, these say transfer up to so much money. It's not necessarily set in stone, but we need the option, because that's what we budgeted, and I can't transfer until I have authorization by the board by resolution. So beginning July 1, I need to have the ability to transfer the dollars when necessary. So that's what this is the budgeted transfers for the year.
Any questions?
Yes. And this is for a refresher for me, please, Lisa. But I know that there are some limits on how much we can transfer from the general fund to the secondary roads fund.
Correct.
And from the rural to the secondary roads fund.
Right.
Okay. And I went and tried to do the formula myself. And the law is actually very complicated. I thought, man, Lisa really rocks when she does those formulas because they aren't as simple as on our little cheat sheet. Okay. So anyway, so it's the $590,000 from general and the $2,150,000 from rural services. Are those the maximums?
No.
All right. Thank you.
Good.
That makes me feel better because my numbers weren't there.
So you have to take the valuation, the countywide valuation, and multiply it by 16.875 for the general. And I think that is in the $700,000 range.
Okay.
You're going to test my memory here because that was a while ago that I did these calculations. The rural valuation times $3.38 is a little over $3 million, which is basically what we levy anyway in that fund. And we have other things that come out of it. So at budget time, when we talked about those, here's the maximum, and here's what I'm recommending, and here's how we ended up. In order for secondary roads to get their road use tax dollars, we have to levy at least 75% of the maximum, or they lose dollar for dollar. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We usually don't levy 100% or the maximum for secondary roads, And the reason we don't is because they also have other sources of revenue from the county, the local option sales tax dollars, which we buy the secondary or the motor graders with. There's $257,000 a year on that. Mm-hmm. We meet the 75%. In fact, we're higher than the 75% required. But in order to provide, we base how much we're going to give them each year on the ending fund balances that they're projecting also. So
in the event, like we've had a rough spring with mm-hmm. the roads, mm-hmm. okay, would we be able to access about that extra $110,000 from the general fund and that extra $850,000 from the rural services if we needed for more road repairs?
The levies are set.
Okay.
Okay. Right. So for the rural fund, mm-hmm. I'm going to have to say no.
All right.
Because we are looking at a rural fund ending fund balance of only like 14.5% anyway.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. For the general fund, that is a decision you can make. It will require a resolution
sure.
of the board is all sure. it will require, and know that you are taking it from the general fund balance. So when we get to fiscal year end, Friday, for me, Friday, when we get to fiscal year end and I put all the numbers together and I say to you, okay, this is where we ended our year, then yes, we can talk about what your preferences are if you'd like to increase that amount, okay?
All right. Thank you. I like I said, and my numbers didn't work out the same as these, and I said, oh, I know I've done something wrong, so thank you.
Yeah, they are not.
Thank you.
Okay. And if there are no other questions, I'd entertain a motion to adopt Resolution 19.132.
I would so move adoption of 19-132 as presented.
I will second that.
Okay. Further discussion? No. Olson?
Aye.
Eddie?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye. Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome.
Next, we have Alyssa Wignall for discussion and consideration of revising open meetings policy and procedure. For open records, I'm sorry.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I took the current open records policy and procedure and just updated the contact information, changed it from Deb Shieldroth to myself, preparing for the transition after this Friday. So that's why you will notice on the item on the agenda, I asked for the 7-day review to be waived. Nothing in the policy has been changed except the contact.
Okay. Okay. Any questions?
None.
I would entertain a motion to adopt the change and for a 7-day review waiver.
I'll make the motion to adopt the change for the open records policy and procedures and the 7-day wait period.
I second.
Okay. Any discussion? If none, Heston?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye. We approved it. Thank you so much for catching that. Next, we have discussion and consideration of announcement of a tourism funding for fiscal year 2020. Supervisor Olson, would you like to explain this?
Sure. This has been a long process here, but it arose with me challenging with a previous board the fact that we were, as year after year, budgeting some money to give to one large special event that comes to the county every year, but not making allowances for other large special events who were not given any money, not told, all right? So when it came before this, the board with Supervisor Merkin, myself, and former Supervisor Sanders, we brought forward, by that time the conversation had come to the discussion that we had put a total of $10,000 in the budget for fiscal year 20, which was a $4,000 increase. Now, previously what had been spent in year after year was $700 that was paid for dues for the convention for the Central Iowa Tourism Association, and then it was automatically $4,000 pretty much just given to Iowa Gates. So this, we raised it to $10,000, and then the question becomes, how do we notify people and disperse this so that everyone figures out if they qualify or not.
At that particular point in time, there was some discussion and some disagreement among that previous board about whether it was necessary to notify people and whether there were any conditions to place on it. And so the end discussion, I believe also, if I recall, Supervisor Merkin asked about why we're giving money anyway to tourism. But I that was just a comment. It was never discussed. I just wanted to bring up all the comments that were previous to bring everybody up to date. So at that time, with knowing that there was going to be a departure on the board, it was just left alone, and now it's come back. We are headed into fiscal year 20, and so we've allocated this money. I'm still looking for some way to officially and fairly notify the other groups in the county that produce events that attract tourism, which we've never defined, okay, in fact, if they would like to apply also. Supervisor Merkin did contact the current ongoing recipients, Iowa Games. They said yes, they could go ahead and ask for, in essence, apply for the money every year. So this is the draft in the form that it last came to the board, with the exception of we've reduced the amount to $9,300 under the assumption that the $700 would be paid to Central Iowa Tourism for our membership. I'm asking this board to take a look and, I guess, decide, are we in fact going to be notify groups that we have budgeted some money and see that everybody gets an equal notification? And does the board want to make any changes about how they want, who they want notified, what kind of conditions on it, and clearly who should they contact? So we've got a work in, I guess I say progress, I'm hoping progress. And with that, I'll leave it.
So I do have a couple questions on that. And I did kind of work on it and drafted something up, but I just had a bunch of questions. So in the past, I'm just trying to figure out, so was it just a direct allocation in the past to the Iowa Games and the Ames Convention Bureau?
Yeah.
So did they, I'm just, you know, I think of the word grant and there's some sort of application process. Was that ever done?
It's kind of informal is what I think the history is, and it was just, we'll just pay that. You don't have to even just submit an invoice. And we did change that a few months ago and said, no, it should, you know, if Iowa Games wants to have support by the county, financial support, they need to send us something every year, and they didn't this year because
the board needs to vote on it. They were just sending an invoice.
And Shelly, you notified them of our decision. Yeah.
So are you looking at, like, some sort of application process then? Do we have that kind of dressed up? Or
no. My original goals here would have been some kind of that they stated what the money was going to be used for, just simple, maybe what the budget was, and how many people they anticipated attending. Now, as I said, when I first broached this, I thought of two groups right off the bat who I thought would qualify closely to Summer Games, and that would be Special Olympics and Maximum Ames. They draw people from outside of Story County. They draw people who stay for a day or two. So, you know, I was trying to meet apples to apples to meet a very insistent prior board that we should just be giving this money, and we've given it for 3 years, okay? But there were other issues that were never brought up. I can anticipate with the way that this particular one is written, we will get everything from applications from the local communities for their yearly festivals, to the Nevada Rodeo that just came up again last year, to groups that wanted to come up, that wanted to bring a new event up. So for me, I thought it was a longer process and the board should set some parameters. But that was not, a former supervisor was not interested in entertaining them. So
I'm open for some parameters.
Well, my question from last time probably stands.
Right.
I don't understand. I mean, and I'm looking at this, I mean, this is a small amount of money. Why am I thinking about this so much? But I found myself, since I found it on the agenda yesterday, thinking about it and thinking about it. So if you don't mind, I'd just like to go ahead and say, you know, government's supposed to get involved in things when there's a failure in the markets, in the private sector. I don't see that there's a failure anywhere here in the private sector can't or won't do these things. I think we've got some pretty healthy events. I think they're pretty well funded. I would admit that of all of them, if we were to say, would there be one to fund and why, I would say Special Olympics, because it provides services to people who with various disabilities or disadvantages, and I think it's a good service to the community. However, I'm not sold that we should do this. I think we do raise expectations. I think we have tons and tons of events saying, well, the county supervisors are funding tourism now. Let's all line up and all try to get our share of this $9,300. And I think we would be raising expectations and causing a whole lot of work that really isn't necessary.
So
that's kind of.
But was it in the budget that you've approved for 1920 with this line item to go directly for this?
We raised it in. It's the tourism line item. There, I understand what Supervisor Merkin is saying, and I see the validity of what she's saying. This all, once again, came about with when I brought it up with the original board, which was two boards ago, is to try and satisfy their adamant insistence that money continue to go to Iowa Games. And so I was looking for a fair way to include others. We wanted to not, other than I believe that there's an expectation when we pay our Central Iowa Tourism $700 fee from this money, actually what happens is then we appoint usually the director of the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau to be our rep on that. We're paying their dues is what it is. Okay. So then if we wanted to take the other $9,300 and say we're not going to spend it, we can reallocate it to another purpose. We could take it and give it to the ACVB as one grant because they every year hand out grants throughout the county. They tend to be focused on Ames because that's where all the hotels are except like three of them. But they give out about $85,000 or more a year, which would be, if we wanted to participate with that money in some fashion, we could let them add it to their pool of money. Or we could just say, we don't have to spend the money. And that would include four Iowa Games. All right? So I'm good with anything as long as we be fair in some way about
Sure. So, What did like the Ames Convention Visitor Bureau use their money for last?
The $700 actually Lisa Markley has left, but I believe she just pays the invoice. To Central Iowa Tourism. Yeah, Deb Shildruff is not in the back of the room. So it's just she paid the invoice.
Okay.
Yeah. So she's a part of the membership.
Correct. And then we have historically appointed the director of the Convention of Visitors Bureau to be our representative. In fact, we get two, by the way.
We've
just only historically done one. So there are a lot of options here that I'm comfortable with as long as we get
there.
Sure. So define fair.
Fair would be that we don't fund just one group. Fair could be we don't fund anybody except for the $700, because I think that the ACVB is expecting, at least for this year, that we fund it. Okay. Fair could be turning it over to the $9,300 to the ACVB. They then just have more money, and they can send out a little press release saying, hey, the county kicked in some money, but it's good for anybody who wants to apply. That means all the local fairs, et cetera, could go ahead and apply to them paperwork-wise, and it's up to the ACVB to determine what meets their criteria. And it's a pretty broad criteria. Speaking to someone who held a grant from them 1 year because the library gave up a grant and it came to me as a private kind of entrepreneur that did some music coverage, said, would you please take on this series? Okay, and I did it for that year. So that would be another way to do it and still provide some money for the fiscal year 20 if we want to do that. But no one is expecting this money with the exception of Iowa Games and possibly Special Olympics because I said I hope we have some money for you.
You talked to the Special Olympics.
I talked to Jan Williams from Special Olympics, but I didn't promise her anything. I just said we're working on this, okay? So like I said, that's what I meant by fair, is that we just don't take one group to single out unless we set some criteria that would make one or two. Now, if we as a board were to set a limit about how many people come in as an estimate and spend the night in hotels and participate in the local economy by eating for a day or so, there will be two that qualify. Iowa Games, I believe, and Special Olympics. Everything else, then, the others that come in, because there are music festivals, et cetera, that come in, they're handled through some kind of group organizations. They're not standalone like Iowa Games would be and Special Olympics. So, yeah. So it's whatever we want to do. So that's my definition of somewhat fair. Is if we set the criteria very narrowly, and like I said,
set the criteria again.
So the criteria would be that there would be an estimated attendance over, I would guess if you win over 5,000 individuals from outside of the county, you would limit it to, I believe, Special Olympics and Iowa Games if you also said that it has to be a standalone nonprofit producing if you want to go further to say an athletic or recreational type event that will take care of eliminating maximum aims. I don't know what their attendance I think is, but I think it's maybe right around 5,000 out of the county. Okay. And then that also should take care of the everything additional except for something special like RAGBRAI, which our board did vote for an extra $6,000 for a one time. And the other one I'm thinking about is the BEAT baseball. BEAT, B-E-P baseball is the blind baseball. The national tournament has come a couple times to Story County. The next level down of events that I'm aware of would get into, there's some, Nevada hosts a softball and Little League, I believe, or adult softball, so there's a tournament there, but I don't know that they would get near those numbers for people who would come in, be spending a day or a couple of days participating in the community and would not be affiliated with the university. So that's kind of where I see the lines being.
Sure. Were you in your kind of criteria? Did you say an estimated attendance of outside of Story County attending?
Right. As kind of just tourism, if you want to go inside, it was special events. We called it special events at one point too.
Can you go ahead and tell me why you think this is a good idea?
I did it, as I said,
Iowa Games, trying to clean up what you thought was a messy situation and unfair, why would it proactively going forward be a good idea to do this?
I don't think it is a good idea. When it comes right down to it, I don't think it is a proactive good idea because it's not enough money. Exactly what is pointed out. I am strictly trying to honor the precedent and the that came before and all the conditions that were put in or not. The other best idea I can do if you want to keep with the money for, the $9,300 is I say let's turn it over to the Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Well,
that would be if you wanted to fund what was budgeted, but we do not have to fund it.
Is the $4,000 loss going to make or break the Iowa Games?
No, and that was another issue for me. That was another huge. To my knowledge, we have no idea what we get it for. Mr. Long, the executive director, comes every year, and we get our photos taken with them, and we get a plaque for the wall. But I don't.
Yeah, I mean, that was just going to be my question is, what do we get from what, in the historically, it was allocated $4,000 or so to them. What did we get? Did that break them from being able to provide something by not receiving that
$4,000? It did not. In no way have they ever in the last few years ever said that they could not put on their event if they did not receive the county's $4,000.
My personal thought is that we can continue to support tourism by continuing to fund the $7,000 towards the membership in Central Iowa Tourism Association.
Do you mean 700?
700.
Yeah, you said 7,000.
I gave them a big raise, didn't
you? Yeah, you did.
Yeah, 700. Correct the record quickly for them, and not to set up a program of our own. I realize that would mean that we would not be funding Iowa Games this year. I don't think it's a huge thing for them. I think I can't see that there's a negative in doing that.
Would they be expecting some assistance for this year since
they
it's
just
getting close? I'm just saying since it would be close to the games time, would they
no,
be expecting?
They received their $4,000
just last month.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
This one,
so
this year. This is for the next fiscal year.
So they're coming out of a fiscal year, you know, they're at the end of the
fiscal
year when they're having it.
They would have plenty of notice in terms of planning for 2020.
Yes. So what this would end up is then the only, if you will, special activity that we fund then would be the fair, the county fair, which is got some other ties, et cetera. It's a separate item on the budget, and we would be out of the activities events funding then. And I have a comfort level with that as long as we stay with the fair. Okay. Because I see the demand would be overwhelming if with everybody trying to put on their yearly festival.
And the pot of money we're talking about right now, none of this goes to the fair, so we're not we're not considering that.
We're not considering it all.
I'm okay with just allocating. I guess I would make the motion to allocate funds to the $700 to the Central Iowa Tourism so that we retain our membership if we are sure that that is the same amount. I guess I shouldn't have asked if that's part of my motion. You can answer that.
You know what? I believe so. It's when Julie Weeks was here right before she left. She'd indicated that. But we could make, would you be open to amending the motion into we pay the dues for that in case it's gone up? And
yes,
that's it.
Yes.
Okay.
I will do that after I started saying that is, yes, that we pay the dues for the Central Iowa Tourism for our membership and not fund the Iowa Games moving forward.
I second that.
Okay. The motion is second. Any further discussion? Teddins?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye. Thank you.
Okay.
A good discussion. Next, we have planning and development. Jerry and Gabe. Gabe or Gabriel?
Hi,
I go by either. I guess I've been signing things Gabriel, but most people call me Gabe.
Hi, Gabe.
Hi.
Okay, so you're going to give us the rundown on this resolution?
Yeah, we're going to work together on this. Gabe's done a great job being a leader on the review of this agricultural subdivision. This is called Thompson Farm Subdivision. And it's currently owned by two sisters, and their partnership is B&B Farm Partnership. And their two sons currently farm this land. They've been farming it for a number of years. And so the goal is to reconfigure what is four existing parcels and to reconfigure that into two, what will become lots. And the goal is for their sons to acquire or take over the ownership of the property. Mr. Dennis Parmeter is here, and he's represented the applicants. We want to thank him for being here. We appreciate the information that he's provided with the submittal, and he's been very helpful in responding to the questions that we've had.
Thank you for kind of starting that off while I pulled it up.
Again, my name is Gabe. I'm excited to be here. I know this is probably a typical meeting for you guys, but it's kind of an exciting day for me. So, like Jerry said, the owners is B&B Farm Partnership. It's two sisters that are looking to deed it to their each of their respective sons. And now when they are dividing it up, there's going to be two different lots. And those lots are both going to have frontage on 320th Street. That first lot is going to be approximately 45 acres, and the lot two will be approximately 86 acres. They do have a current access point. It is on proposed lot two, right next to parcel C. That is the little cutout parcel, and I do have a laser pointer. It's right along here. There is an access point, and we have recommended to the property owners through the attorney to just have an easement between the two properties.
Right. It's on the west side of that smaller parcel. Just a little bit of background. Again, we're in Section 26. It includes the four parcels, the districts that are in this area, A1 zoning. It's in the Ballard School District. Huxley Ambulance and Fire provide service in this area. Alliant Energy provides electric service. It's in the South Skunk River watershed, and there's two drainage districts, number 24 and 115.
A little bit about, this is a little zoom out. The star indicates where the property is. As you can see from this aerial image, it is right along Huxley. It's adjacent to that, and we'll get in further more about the location of it. So the land use in the area, it is A1 agricultural land use, and it's also designated by the C2C future land use map as a agricultural conservation area. The purpose of that is to preserve large agricultural areas that are primarily used for farming and agricultural purposes. Then it is also, there are some sections in green that I have labeled that are part of the natural resource area. Through our discussions with county conservation, we've been led to believe that these maps may be in error and not truly reflecting the field conditions there. On either side of the property, there is the Heart of Iowa Nature Trail. And we believe that was trying to indicate the trail's path there. It does run north of the property right now. And Jerry will actually talk more about that on the next slide.
So this is the Heart of Iowa Nature Trail. The left photo shows the actual alignment extending through the city of Huxley. There's a portion of that where they're actually on the road right away, which is just north of the subject property that's just before the board. And then it extends south on 535th Avenue and then westerly towards Slater. The entire route is a little over 30-some miles. There's some areas that are not constructed yet, but overall it's about 30-some miles. That was the previous Milwaukee-Illinois. And again, through discussions with the conservation staff, while the current alignment extends along the road right away, the subject property, again, that we're looking at would be right in this area for existing parcels. So as you extend a ride through the city, you're required to stay on the road right away. And so the goal is to try to improve the efficiency and safety and come up with a alignment on private property if that's possible. The city of Huxley did take action on the subdivision plat. They brought this up as something that they wanted us to communicate with the property owners, which we did, and they have indicated that they're interested in talking to the conservation staff about providing an easement. The preferred location is likely in the southern portion of what is considered the subject property. And this is something that will occur with conservation staff and the property owners after action on the subdivision plan.
Yep. So some of the other surrounding land use, you can see in our aerials that to the north, the west and the south of the subject property is mainly large agricultural use. And then on the east side, we do have some other uses as well. You can see the city of Huxley is to the east of the property. And then there is also an abandoned railroad right-of-way that is not in the city of Huxley, but it is owned by the city of Huxley. And there is also a very skinny parcel between the city of Huxley and the subject property that is owned by County Conservation. It is designated as a park. And so that's that proposed bike route that we did show. It did follow along this line here. That would be in County Conservation Park area.
This bike trail that you're showing, does this happen to be, would it be like a connector for a subdivision to the Heart of Iowa Trail? And the reason I'm asking is having to do with something that you guys don't deal with, but it's an application from the city for help paving, something like that.
Yeah, the current route is shown in green.
Uh-huh.
And so this is how, if you're going to ride on the trail, you access it. The gray area represents the corridor to Huxley.
Okay.
And so you're required to stay out on the road right away for about a half a mile and then extend south on 535th Avenue and then west. So
it's not.
The goal
Thank
would be
you.
To
that
try helps. To stay on private property, and so it would also include discussions with the landowners.
Okay. Thank you. That helps clear up my thought about whether this is a separate piece or not. It is. Okay, thank you.
Continuing with surrounding land use, I just wanted to note within a 1/4 of a mile, there are 97 other parcels. 15 of those are in unincorporated Story County. And of those 15, there was just 3 that had single-family dwellings on them. 11 were bare land, and one contained an additional building. And we'll actually see some of those in our photos. Starting with this photo, I'll try and kind of flip through these sort of quickly, but this star on the mini map indicates where we took the photo from, just to give you guys an idea. And here we are looking north from the property. This is on the Heart of Iowa Nature Trail, part of it where it is paved. From that same position, we are now looking east onto proposed Lot 2. And this is looking at the abandoned railroad right-of-way that the city of Huxley currently owns, and is from that same location that we took this photo, looking south. And this is one more looking west towards Lot 2. Here is adjacent property. This is to the east of the subdivision. It is on 320th Street. As we go west from there, we can look at proposed Lot 2, and we do see in the distance that railroad right-of-way where that tree cover is. This is another shot just coming farther west on that road. And here's parcel C, that small cutout that I indicated earlier, and is kind of right next to that current access point right now. So you can see parcel C in the distance on the left here, and this is just another shot of Lot 2. And here is that access point that we were mentioning before. It's a little, you can see the tire marks in the mud there. And here's one more from that location looking over the lots. If we look across the street, we're looking northwest now, we see one of those single-family dwellings.
And here we are looking north again from Lot 2, and we can see that there are some livestock across the street, and there is that extra building structure. Here's one more looking north, and in the distance you can see the Ballard High School in the distance. And then this is looking towards the city of Huxley if you were to continue driving, and you can see some more agricultural uses there.
So the Story County Land Development Regulations for agricultural subdivisions require these things. The lots created by the subdivision are intended to be used for ag purposes, which is the case here. Subdivision contains no new development lots. The subdivision includes no land set aside for new streets, alleys, parks, dedicated open space, school property, or public use. And the subdivision lies wholly within an A1 or A2. No ag or minor subdivisions have been approved for the subject property being divided after December 31, 2003.
Now on to the comments. We did send this out to our interagency review team on May 16th. From most of our agencies, we received no comment or no concerns from all of them, I should say. Then we did have some comments from the city of Huxley when they took action on it on June 11th. They kind of had two notes or two conditions for the development, and one was that we do consider that trail easement that we had talked about, and the second was just that if there's ever an action to make this subdivision residential, that it would follow the city of Huxley's guidelines. And we did also send out a public notice to all the properties in 1/4 of a mile in both City of Huxley and unincorporated Story County, and we have not heard any responses. Some points to consider when we're looking at this is, one is the goal of the subdivision is to divide four parcels into two lots, and they're both going to have that frontage on 320th Street. The second thing to consider is that it does meet all the requirements and standards for an agricultural subdivision, and there's the future use is going to be for agriculture. The two sons have farmed it for the last 10 years, and they're intending to continue that trend in the foreseeable future. And then the third thing to look at is just that access point is going to be on Lot 2. But it will serve both lots, and we have recommended that easement between them. So based on the submittal application, site review, staff report, Story Conservation and staff meetings, and some responses from the applicant and an attorney, which were very helpful, we do recommend the approval of Alternative 1, and that is the Story County Board of Supervisors approves Resolution 19-124, the agricultural parcel subdivision plat, Thompson Farm subdivision, as put forth in subdivision 08-19.
And to be clear on the City of Huxley's comments, the proposed easement for Heart of Iowa Trail would be between conservation and the owners. That's nothing to do with our action here today. And of course, if there were a subdivision, City of Huxley would be ruling in terms of the requirements there.
Yeah, yes. Contiguous, and I wouldn't be surprised if they would be interested in having the future development annex.
I would think that would be, so neither of those are, I mean, those are comments they made, but they're nothing that's within our authority.
We're
just acknowledging those.
Yep.
Okay.
We also have a work program item two that our department's working on for levels of service, and so it's conceivable that, you know, proposed development is within a half mile, that they would meet certain criteria, but that's something that we need to develop with city administrators and the officials.
And there's no rural water there?
There's not.
Is Xenia? Not that we have anything to.
As far as the district.
Yeah, I know. I just wondered. Denny.
Yeah. Well, all the land we're talking about is, I'm built. I mean, it's tillable farmland. There's no development of on. Now there's an acreage there that's cut out,
yeah.
Which was originally the family farm before they carved
okay.
it out. But there's no need for any water.
Right.
I mean, there's no
okay.
well.
So
there's no water need to the.
Okay, family. They're not building a house here. They're just dividing the land. Okay,
no.
got
okay.
it. Thank you. Okay. Any questions?
None. No. Seems pretty straightforward.
Okay. Thorough report. Thank you. I'm going to entertain a motion for approval of Resolution
19-124. I'll move approval of Resolution 19-124.
Second?
Second.
By Olson. Okay. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Hedden?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye.
Okay. Good job on your first
Thank you very
time.
Much.
Thank you for your time, yeah.
Okay. Now, am I correct that item 7 is going to be moved to a future agenda?
Correct.
Okay, Leanne? Is that right? Okay. So we'll that, department reports, there are none. Other reports, there are none. Upcoming agenda items, is there anything either of you would like to suggest that we... Looking at?
Can't think of right now.
Okay.
Not at this particular time.
Okay. Public forum number 2, comments from the public on items not on this agenda. Dustin?
I'll pass today. Thank you.
Okay. Liaison assignments, committee meeting updates, and announcements from the supervisors. Who would like to start?
Please go ahead. Well, I have this week the Central Iowa Recovery meeting I will be out at, as well as the CICS meeting on Thursday. And then Friday, I have the Juvenile Justice Committee up in Eldora. I guess I should also take a step back. Is Wednesday, I have the cash count that I'll be out with Lisa Markley.
Cool.
Oh, mm-hmm. sorry. Okay. And then I'll be in the working in Ames for the day.
Okay. Thank you.
For me, the HRDA meeting got moved. So now it's Friday. we hope. Okay. And I am going to attend the Ames City Council meeting tonight, or at least watch it online. They're going to discuss community broadband. And about a year and a half ago, when Dustin, when you came, former Supervisor Chitty and Dustin were working on some broadband discussions with Colo, I think, was that Colo Telephone, and talking about the outlying areas. And then, of course, the other thing that now we've received word on has been that the ARINET proposal, which was out of the university, and that did not make the cut for funding this year, at least. But once again, that was a proposal based upon looking at connectivity from a farming and agricultural standpoint. So for me, it's worth, I guess, going tonight and listening. I know that on the work plan we looked at for Leanne Harder, she also, you've got some updates coming yourself, right, on connectivity reports or Iowa broadband?
It's part of the...
I'm making everybody get up and walk up today, right?
Those items that you just questioned are in the Connect Iowa program or
uh-huh.
plan that the board adopted 4 or 5 years ago. So that's been that's been ongoing since we became a Connected Iowa County.
Okay. Right. So those are the items that you're focused on then, right?
Right.
Okay. Super.
That are specifically for the Board of Supervisors.
Okay. Thank you. So anyway, so I feel that sitting in the back of the room might give me some insight
okay.
about any efforts already underway that might
Great.
Be.
We look forward to hearing about it.
Okay.
Super. Anything else?
That's it. I'm good.
Okay. I'm just going to report on a couple of events that are going on this week. This Thursday in this room from 9 to 11, we have a farewell reception for Deb Shildreth. So everybody's invited to that. We look forward to that and are very sad about it at the same time, but we look forward to Deb going on and having a job that she's really excited about, and we're excited to work with her as a city employee. So, and then Friday, the Tedesco Environmental Learning Corridor opening will be a brief agenda. It starts at 3 o'clock, a social hour, 3 to 4. 4 to 5 is a program, a ribbon cutting then at 5 o'clock, and then from 5 to 6 there are tours and activities. So I hope everybody can join us Friday afternoon at the Tedesco Environmental Learning Corridor. Anything else that we've forgotten?
No.
Okay, if not, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Okay. Wilson?
Aye.
Hedden?
Aye.
Merkin? Aye. We are adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.